Fred Film Radio, Berlin International Film Festival, Germany.
Fred Film Radio, this is Dana Knight reporting from the 64th edition of Berlin International Film Festival. I am here with Dan Geller and Dana Goldfein discussing their new documentary, The Galapagos Affair. If you could tell me a few things about the film. It's very sensational, very Hitchcockian. I had difficulty trying to imagine what it would look like after I read the press notes.
And did you see it?
Yes, I saw it.
Oh, okay.
It is very Hitchcocky, and it's a combo of Hitchcock and Agatha Christie. It's this odd combination of documentary where you're really learning about people's story and stories, and yes, this unsolved murder mystery from many different perspectives, kind of Rashomon-like, and it's unclear who, and a lot of unreliable narrators. It's unclear who's telling the truth ever, if anyone is. Do you want
to? No, I think that answers it.
Yeah. How did you come across this story?
It was an accident, one of these wonderful accidents where our first introduction to the story came when we were working on another project, a science project, for a friend, actually, where I was on camera, Dana was doing sound, and we had this fabulous Galapagos experience shooting this interactive education project. And while we were down there, came across a book on our boat that had a chapter called Murder in Paradise. That was very intriguing, especially to Dana, who loves true crime stories. And although we were not meant to stop on the island of Floriana, our itinerary was set differently. Our boat ran into trouble, and we had to stop on Floriana. And that's when we met Margaret Whitmer. She was very old, but she was still alive and kicking. And several years later, we were told by the same friend of an archive of footage that was shot between 1929, 1934, 35 by Captain Alan Hancock and his crew. Each year they would go through Galapagos on the way to the Marquesas on scientific research, and there's this archive, we were told. And we got around to looking at that archive eventually and realized that it was falling to pieces. And there was no money to support the archive, and the film was disintegrating. And we asked the archive, if we took the risk to transfer it to a digital medium, could we have rights to the footage exclusively for a good chunk of time? And they said yes. And when those reels started going through the system to translate it to digital media, we realized that we had all the visual material that we would need in order to make the story come alive. And that's when we hit the gas.
Great. The archive material is really beautiful and very intriguing. It was so surprising to see even footage of Berlin in 1929. It's really very interesting, and how you blended everything together. But what stands out the most are the characters, and probably that's what attracted you.
Yes.
And could you please talk about your favorite personality in this film? I mean, there are too many, really. But
I mean, I think, I don't know if it's favorite, but the one that, probably because there's still so many mysteries about her, would be the Baroness. I mean, because all the other people wrote and left behind either journals or actually entire books, the only thing that is in print that we've ever been able to find of the Baroness is an interview that she did with an Ecuadorian newspaper right before she and Philipson and Lorenz went to the island. So I think in terms of the person who I ponder the most, I would have to say the Baroness, because she remains such an enigma. And even when you hear in the film that she might have been a spy during World War I, or, you know, she was a dancer, who knows? Who knows if she was a Baroness? I do think she was Viennese. I do believe her on that. I think she did something in Paris, because we have that photo of her. But who, other than those things, who really knows?
Yeah, it's interesting that everybody recorded their existence. Everybody wrote a book or there's something, but she didn't. Probably she was more interested in the living rather than the recording of it.
Well, she also didn't have time, because she was murdered or disappeared or sailed away. So she wasn't even in the islands all that long, certainly not long enough to have survived it all and written about it. I mean, Dora, even though she left the islands, Dora did write a book in years later back here in Germany. And Margaret, of course, wrote her journals. So in the same way that Ritter never really could write a full book or journal because he died on the islands, so too with the Baroness. She never really had a chance to sit down and write her memoirs. But you do raise an interesting point. She probably was so living in the moment and with the future in mind that for her to sit down and look backward and write, I don't know if she had the personality.
Yeah.
I'm
putting my own bias, obviously, onto her, but I kind of feel like if she had been able to live to a ripe old age, or even a, well, she was kind of middle-aged when she got there, but a ripe old age, I feel like she probably would have written something. And whether it was true or not, you know, who knows, because I do think she was a fabulist. But I can't imagine. She sought fame so much. I can't imagine she would not have wanted to go down in history by writing something.
Yeah, probably. So Dan, what is your favorite of the characters?
Well, I am enchanted by the moderns, as we call them, the people who are living, especially on Santa Cruz Island, who were born there to parents who moved there many, many years ago. And so, and they weave in and out of the murder mystery story, almost like a Greek chorus. So I'm fascinated by people like Friedel Horneman, who ultimately left Galapagos, but was born and was raised there, and their experiences in living in a paradise that was very similar as far as the environment to what the people on Floriana had to contend with. So I that to me, I think there's a pull to think, well, what if you were a child? It's like the Robinson Crusoe story or Swiss Family Robinson. If you were a child in that environment, basically that really isn't, that is Eden at that point. You cannot be an adult and go to a beautiful island and have the innocence of Eden because you've experienced life already. But to be a child and grow up there, there are photos of the De Roy family when they were children, Jill and his sister, Tui. These photos of pure freedom and joy. You just see it in their bodies, feeding these birds and animals running down a beach. And to me, there's some magic pull about that. Maybe that's the closest, you know, anyone could ever get on this earth to a notion of innocence in Eden.
Yeah, and it's interesting how this Eden very quickly turned into hell when the other groups arrived. I thought that's such a pervasive irony. Yeah. You know, Sartre said, put two people in a room and you get hell. So this kind of story is like similar.
It really is. And also I think what I say is it's as if you got the opportunity to leave society and go to your own island, and you brought with you a very distinct vision of what paradise was, and determined to create that. And lo and behold, you get to this island, and there's someone else who's already there with a very different and very clashing idea of paradise. What do you do? Since everyone has their own notion of what paradise is, you know, for the Baroness, it was a hotel. For millionaires, for Friedrich, it was isolation. So what do you do with a clashing notion of paradise?
We'll be back with Dan Geller and Dana Goldfein in a few minutes. Fred Film Radio at Berlinale, back with Dan Geller and Dana Goldfein.
But I would say also, well, there's a saying that, you know, someone is so belligerent that you could lock them in a closet and they would pick a fight with themselves within 5 minutes. And I think there's truth to that, too, that you could go alone on an island, not even with a clashing vision of paradise to someone else. If the island, if you're utterly alone, not even in the case of Ritter with his partner, Dora, I think if Ritter had gone alone, he would have picked a fight with himself in 5 minutes. So that goes to what Fritz Heber says toward the end of the movie, where, you know, if you have problems, you take the problem with you wherever you go. And so you will not find peace or have an Eden if inside you is turmoil.
But another irony is that Friedrich, he wanted to be alone on that island, but then he published all those articles in the German press.
It's actually been one of my big questions since we started this project, or since we first even read the story. You know, it's how ironic. Because in a way, he was his own downfall. And also the way he put his descriptions out into the world, he made it sound much more idyllic especially for other Europeans who were in the interwar years, and it was very bleak. And so the way he wrote about, I mean, he had a three-part article series in the Atlantic Monthly in which he actually used biblical terms, and it was very much like, you know, she's Eve and I'm Adam, and, you know, it's this kind of paradise here. Of course people were, and then he was shocked that people came. So yeah, the irony that, I always say it's funny that they all went off to be on an island, and yet they all brought typewriters.
Because they all wanted to be philosophers and become great writers. I mean, I was so impressed with the aspirations of all these people. It's quite amazing. It's almost, it's hard to believe it's a real life story. Mm-hmm. You'd say somebody made it up, Hitchcock or who knows. Yeah. And I wanted to ask you about the research trip, because probably that was an adventure in itself. How long did that take? And
well, the research trip, we went down actually with someone who's doing the travel logistics for us, who works for a company in the United States. And just by coincidence, she was coming down to inspect the boats and inspect the hotels. It's part of their rating system. And she was the one who made the introductions to some of the families on Santa Cruz Island in particular. So that research trip suddenly took on a whole new angle. We knew we were going to go to Floriana, which we did, and look at the caves and look at the Whitmer compound and go to Ritter's Place, just to get a sense of the lay of the land and hopefully meet Rolf and Florianita Whitmer, Margaret and Heinz's adult children. But we did not know we were going to meet all these other people on Santa Cruz and spend time in their houses and chat with them and begin to learn their stories and then ask them if they would participate in the movie. So that came as a huge surprise. As we left the islands on that first trip, we realized that we were going to make a movie that expanded in scope and that was more than just the archival murder mystery. It would be a far more difficult movie to accomplish, but also, we think, ultimately a much richer one for having these other people weave through the film.
Yeah, because I think, you know, the research trip, we were there for maybe 10 days. We knew we were going to go back and actually film 6 months later. But initially, yeah, we thought, well, what we're going to do is we're going to spend time on Floriana. We're going to actually go to look at Ritter's grave, and we're going to walk up to the caves and see, you know, how we could film there. So at first it was going to be just a logistical trip in many ways. And then as we started, you know, islands are small, even if there's a lot of people living on them. So we would meet one person, and then they would say, oh, you have to meet this person. And you know, this person is someone who, like, you know, Carmen Angermeyer, she's in her 80s now, and she came when she was six. And so go talk to her. And, you know, we just kind of got passed from one person to another. Yeah.
Were you ever tempted to set up shop and create a paradise of your own there?
In the Galapagos?
Yeah.
No. I think it, though it is a beautiful place, I prefer a city life. It's just my own nature. And I think I like anonymity. You know, it's one thing to be out and put a film out and engage with audiences and have a great time with it. But, you know, by and large, Dana and I are both anonymous in San Francisco. We walk down the street and don't know most of the people. And that's really nice because you can preserve some sense of privacy on an island like Floriana, or to some extent Santa Cruz even today, you cannot be anonymous, and everybody knows everybody else's business. And I think I much prefer not having everybody know my business.
and actually, I don't agree. Well, for me, yes, I was tempted. The first time we went there in 1998, I didn't know a thing about the islands, and I didn't expect them to affect me in the way that they did, but I can still physically remember the feeling of stepping onto my first Galapagos island. It wasn't one that people lived on, but being with those animals and thinking of, I mean, we've heard of Darwin from the time we're, you know, in school for the first time. So for me, being in that place was a very profound feeling, and emotionally and psychologically. And I remember saying to myself, I know I'm going to come back here. These islands mean something more than just this 1-2 week trip. So then when we went back in 2007 to do the research, I felt it even more. And then we went back for like a five-week shoot. And I said to Dan, I think it scared him. I was like, Dan, don't you wish we could like get some land here? The safe.
It's free or it's not?
It's not anymore. In fact. Because when the government would give 50 hectares to anyone who wanted to settle there, but that all stopped. It became a national park in the late 60s, and they grandfathered in like maybe 3% or something like that of the land that was already occupied on four different islands, and that was it. And now it's so protected that even Ecuadorians can't emigrate there, even though it is owned by Ecuador. The only people who can stay on the islands are people who are born there or people who were there before, you know, 1990-something. So Dan was relieved, because even though I did have this momentary aspiration, but I do want to always be able to go back there. I feel very connected. Dan and I went down in October to show the film to the people who are in it. And, you know, with island people, you never know what they're going to think. And so I remember saying, you know, Dan, this might be our last trip to the islands. And I was very sad, because I thought if they didn't like the film, they might not like us anymore. We might not be able to be comfortable going back there. And it was with great relief that they did. So we can go back. So I still feel very connected. I know. It was like after we showed it to the first few people, because there's no theater in the Galapagos. You have to go house to house and show them. I turned it in. I said, I think we can come back.
We'll be back with Dan Geller and Dana Goldfein in a few minutes. Fred Film Radio at Berlinale, back with Dan Geller and Dana Goldfein. I'm also very interested in the script, because I know you based it on all those novels, all that material, but there was a script where you tried to interweave all these stories, and I was fascinated by the music, the musical score, and if you could comment a bit about this.
Sure, the script, which is based on Dora Strauss's writings, Margaret Whitmer's writings, and then publications, magazines, and newspaper articles where Ritter and everybody else in Hines are quoted, formed the backbone of what we wanted to feel like a movie, where people are speaking and contradicting and engaging with each other. To get to that took a lot of digging in all that material so that it would flow like a drama, and a lot of experimentation. But ultimately, it is a script. It's an adaptation, basically, an adapted script from about 12 different sources infused into one whole piece, with the actors doing a tremendous job bringing the drama to life and feeling like they are all in the same movie together. You know, it's not like one performance is over on one side and another performance and tone is something else and crazy. They're all wonderfully in the same movie this way. Early on that was something we really wanted to do, to avoid an omniscient narrator, to avoid someone telling you how to interpret what happened, but rather have them, you know, from the beginning come from the ground up and help you experience it and be with them. That was always the ambition. We've written along the way the documentaries we've written. And the first film we'd made many years ago about Isadora Duncan was all in her words. So we'd done that before. But we hadn't really done it with that many sources and that many characters. So it was a bit of a challenge.
Yeah. Yes, it's crazy how many characters, really.
Well, in the murder, in just the murder mystery, there's seven, really, seven voices. And we did, it is a documentary, so we did want to be true to their words. So it was this combination of culling the story, the pieces of each person's story, finding the best things that each person said. In some cases, we reshaped their words a bit, certainly changed tenses, moved paragraphs around, but we really felt that it was important to in order for each of those characters to have their own voice, we needed to use as much of the writing in those voices, because Margaret's writing is quite different from Dora's writing. Dora's is much more poetic, and Margaret's is, you know, a little bit more straightforward. And then John Garth, who's the American scientist who kept a journal that we took from, I feel like he's the, aw shucks, I'm seeing human nature for the first time. Like, he was kind of the naive young scientist that comes in. I mean, his journal reads that way. It's like, oh my God, I'm actually seeing humanity and the dark side of humanity for the first time. So it was a matter of shaping those different voices and being true to those voices and then weaving them. Mm-hmm. Oh, the music you wanted to ask about.
And also, on this note, Cate Blanchett, did she get to choose the character she wanted to be, or?
Well, that's a good question, because at first we thought, wow, with someone like Cate, we would give, when we finally worked up the nerve to ask her. We became friends when she was in San Francisco a year ago. And then to work up the nerve to ask her without making her feel like we were using her for this, which was never the case. We really enjoyed each other as friends. But when we worked up the nerve, and thought, well, maybe she'll do the role of the Baroness because it's a smaller role. It steals the movie in its own way, but it's a smaller role. But when we talked, and of course she said she never wanted to presume that she would do a role in the movie. She didn't want to presume just because she had seen it and we'd been friends. It's so funny that way, both directions. But when we said, oh God, we'd love you to do any of the roles, you know, would you do the role of Dora Strauss?
She said, I'll do any role you want me to do.
Right. She said that. Yeah. She said, I'll do any role. And we said, we asked her, would you do the role of Dora Strauss? She said, absolutely. You tell me, I'll take any role you want. And so it was phenomenal that she took this role. I mean, it's a challenging and fantastic role. It's a big role in the movie. So that was a real delight and surprise. The music is so crucial to this movie, and Laura Karpman is a tremendously talented composer. She also did work on the most recent film before this, Something Ventured, and so she's a highly, highly trained musician and composer. And early on, when we were playing with temporary music, it was a more electronic, weird, just to create a mood of strangeness. And Laura said, you guys, you don't understand. You have in some ways, what feels like a classic Hollywood thriller on your hands too. You need to bring some of that into how we approach the score and not be afraid of a string orchestration and let it get bigger at points. And we at first were saying, I don't know, Laura, that's not our kind of score and movie. She said, trust me, let me try some things. I'll give you some temporary cues. And she gave us those cues and we said, oh my God, you are so right. So she's managed in this score to very subtly blend some of the classic elements of that kind of fiction movie score with weirdness that would not normally be associated with this kind of score or any documentary score for that matter. So she's, I just think the world of her, incredible talent.
Yes, it's truly fascinating. And one last thing, the role of the editor, I imagine, was tremendous on this film. Seriously, I could not imagine how you would pull this together. So if you could say a few things about that.
Yeah, so our editor is this wonderful editor, Bill Weber, and we had not worked with him until this. And I think, in fact, one of the things for me that made me want to work with him, sometimes editors are, they approach you with a certain amount of arrogance. And when he came to talk with us about the project for the first time, he said, I'm very intimidated by it. It's huge. And that made me want to work with him because I felt like it should be scary. You know, it is a giant story. We knew it was going to take time. I think though even he was surprised that it took almost 2 years to really wrestle it into shape. And with all kind of films with this many characters and this complicated a story, it's about trial and error. We went down many wrong paths with Bill. It was a very collaborative process. So he would cut a sequence and we would sit and look at it, and then sometimes Dan would go in and reshape the sequence, and then we would all look at it again, and then I would go in. You know, Dan and I were sort of writing the script as he was working with the modern characters, and it was just a very fluid back and forth, you know, try one thing, look at it, realize we made a horrible botch of things, going back, recutting it. But yes, Bill, he's a hero. So
we'll be back with Dan Geller and Dana Goldfine in a few minutes. Fred Film Radio at Berlinale, back with Dan Geller and Dana Goldfine. And also, you seem to be attracted to challenges of this kind, because it's not the first multiple character narrative that you're pulling off.
We we really thought with this one, after Ballet Russe, and it was right before we started Something Ventures, so we hadn't begun that project, we really thought with this one, let's tell a simple murder mystery. Let's just make it a little easier on ourselves. We really thought that. I remember saying, God, I don't want to go through that again. And as soon as we met the Islanders and realized their stories were so deeply moving, and that this was the moment to get them, because another few years yet, you know, some of them are in their 80s, you don't know how long they'll be around. We thought, all right, we're going to do it again. We just will have to do it. And the challenge, in the middle of it, the challenge is extremely exhausting and filled with self-doubt. Will we ever pull it off? That when it's done, and it seems the movie is being well received, which is nice, and certainly our audience yesterday at the Festia was amazing. They were with that movie and laughing and intrigued. Then the reward for having dived into the deep end of the pool, right? That reward is a beautiful swim.
Well, and also, and this is not speaking for Dan, because I don't think he feels this way at all, but I always say that unless I'm a little bit terrified when we start a project, then I shouldn't do it. I love the challenge, and I love not quite being absolutely certain that we will be able to pull it off when we set out on a journey. It's just kind of keeps you on your toes. So I embraced the fear and the terror of working with this many characters. And actually, even if we had just told the murder mystery part and left out all of the modern, it was still 7 very complicated stories to tell, characters to weave together. So even that would have been scary, but this was terrifying.
Also, just thinking about the weaving, the way that Kate plays off of Diane Kruger is amazing, because Kate seems like her interpretation of Dora Wrightley is someone who seems so head in the clouds and wishful thinking, although she's hiding something nasty. And Diane's Margaret is much more, you know, confrontative and abrupt in a way. And they play wonderfully against each other, as does Thomas Kretschmann, who's so cold and surgical against Dora. It's so nasty that people laugh. It's just the response. You think, how can this man be so mean to her? And Sebastian Koch, who came to the screening yesterday, was just fabulous as Heinz, who's sort of the counterweight to Margaret. Heinz is gentler and a kinder person and harder to upset. So to watch the weave also of the performances, and once those performances came to life, was a treat. It's almost like going to a stage play and saying, wow, look at these people. They're doing these roles. It's, you know, we're great. We sit back and enjoy them.
A real orchestra of voices and everything. Absolutely. Yeah, yeah. So many layers to this film. And I was wondering if you're ever tempted to add the layer, like the making of the Galapagos affair to it, like how you arrived to the island and that have been just throw in another layer. That have been
DVD extras.
Yeah, no, you know, it's so funny, we the one kind of film we've never made is a personal, I mean, we never put ourselves in our films. And I actually, personally, I respect filmmakers that do that. It's just not what I want to do.
More the French style of documentary. Mm-hmm.
I guess. I mean, I don't totally believe in the fly on the wall either, but because I do think you do affect a situation and change it just by entering it with a camera and a microphone. But I feel like the world is so rich. I'd rather ponder what other people are thinking. I mean, to me, being able to enter a situation as a documentary filmmaker, it's much richer to leave myself out of it and to just explore their world. It's the key. I mean, we are in certain ways participants in that we, for better or for worse, have never left a documentary or finished a documentary and then left behind those people. Our life and our friendship circle just keeps getting bigger and bigger. So it's not so much that we're just observers. Like, those people in the Galapagos are very dear to us. And, like, you know, we do go back and we do see them and we have email relationships with them. And, you know, Fritz Heber came from Frankfurt and we just hung out for 2 days. So it's not like cold observer, but I never personally feel like I need to thrust myself in as part of the story, because the story we're telling is so much, to me, is more interesting than myself.
It's an amazing story. It's true. And thank you so much, Dana and Dan, for being with us on Fred Film Radio, the Festival Insider.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
Fred Film Radio, 24/7 on Fred.fm and smartphone apps.